Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
As everybody else, I thank Morten and Karsten for the kind invitation to Jennifer and I to present in this conference. I was also part of the fact-finding project, so it's nice to follow the trend. Also, apparently, given what's happened since yesterday, I meant to say that I don't speak in the capacity of any institutions I work for, so I don't speak in the name of Leiden University, but generally nobody else in Leiden University agrees with me, so that's a given. And also, I don't speak in the name of the defense team of Laurent Gbagbo, on which I work as well, so I speak in my own name. I've always been intrigued by those caveats, because if I say something stupid about the case, it will be attributed to the defense team anyway. And I was thinking of the prosecution people who said this, but that's why you're invited, because you're OTP. If you were just in your personal capacity, you wouldn't be sitting here and presenting. So anyway, so the caveat is done. Let's move on. Every year when I teach ICL, or when I teach International Criminal Procedure, I ask my students, can you define ICL for me? And I get a range of answers. And most of the time, not always, the answers I get first are to end impunity for international crimes, or to end the commission of crimes like genocide, or to help victims. These are the first answers I get. And usually at this point, this is perfect when I get those answers, because I point out that none of the definitions I'm given prevent us from taking someone, putting him against a wall, and shooting him. That's fighting impunity, that's deterrence, that's also punishment, that's also retribution for victims. All of this fits with putting someone against a wall and shooting them. And usually that makes my students think that, in fact, what they're missing there is fair trial, is a certain procedure by which all of this is done. So prohibition of genocide is just a prohibition. It's not ICL. What's important in ICL is the procedure by which, in what we consider a modern democratic legal system, we do this. We enforce this kind of prohibition. But what the students tell me is symptomatic of something, is that the defense is absent. Is absent of the discussions. It's a paradox, because the first thing we think of when we think of international crimes is the perpetrators, the Gaddafis and the Assads and the Bashirs. So we already think we know, because the media says so, who's guilty. But then when it comes to the procedures, they are often invisible, as we call our paper. So to follow on Matthew's metaphor, it's quite appropriate. So we had the Cheshire cat, the elephant in the room, and I just want to add to this elephant in the room with this, if it works. So this elephant who needs psychoanalysis. So that's a defense in international criminal proceedings. Now, you might tell me that when it comes to preliminary examinations, that's actually normal. It's a preliminary examination, there's no situation, so obviously there's no case. There's no reason to look at the defense. There's no reason to look at the accused or to consider their rights or their position. But in fact, as we're going to present in the next few minutes, this is quite different, because the accused / alleged perpetrators appear on a number of occasions during the preliminary examination. And I'm going to give the floor to Jennifer, and then I'll take it again.
Okay, it's a bit hard to come after Dov because he's too good at this, so I will be much more technical about this poor alleged accused during the PE. So during the PE, the OTP will obviously analyze the seriousness of the information received, information that will come from different sources. In doing so, they are actually doing what we could call a pre-investigation, even if it's not an investigation as such. During this pre-investigation, which will of course have an impact on the formal investigation, the OTP will have to verify the seriousness of the existence of crimes that might have been committed. But what does this mean concretely? Because even during a PE, the OTP will have to analyze evidence presented by potential victims, NGOs, states, members of civil society, or even members of the political opposition. This evidence that is presented to the OTP or requested by the OTP will not only concern potential crimes, it will also target alleged perpetrators. Perpetrators are elements of the crimes, and no PE can ignore who these perpetrators may be. These are not invisible people. They exist from the very beginning in any examination in criminal proceedings. The targets, if we may say so, are even, in our opinion, at the core of a serious examination. Because as a lawyer, you cannot build a case by ignoring who is the alleged perpetrator. This is true from a practical and legal perspective. And we will develop this a little bit more in our paper, but to focus on those individuals, who are these individuals? And what place do they have in a PE? How come they are usually very notorious, but do not seem to exist during a PE? The people being identified as perpetrators during a PE don't have a real legal status. They're not suspects yet, and they're not accused at this point. How should these targeted perpetrators be taken into account by the OTP during a PE? Because even if they are invisible procedurally speaking, they do exist during a PE. And in some circumstances, the OTP does not ignore them at all. For example, in the Gbagbo case, documents on the record of the case show that the prosecutor's investigation focused on Laurent Gbagbo from the very early stage. For example, during an interview with France 24, as early as in January 2011, the prosecutor warned the Gbagbo camp explicitly and exclusively of the risk of prosecution by the court. In April 2011, during an interview in a Kenyan television documentary on Laurent Gbagbo's prosecution by the ICC, the prosecutor responded to the question of whether Laurent Gbagbo would be prosecuted one day by saying that it will come to, and I quote, a bad ending. It is certain that in the circumspection inherent in the position of the prosecutor and respect to the presumption of innocence to which he is bound by the court statute imply that he could not have reached such a conclusion without being privy to concrete facts to support his statement, and thus that he was in possession of evidence on which he based such an assertion. The OTP clearly focused its examination on him, even prior to the 23rd of June 2011, request to the pre-trial chamber for leave to open a formal investigation into the situation in Côte d'Ivoire. So in the Gbagbo case, during the PE, Gbagbo was clearly already a target by the OTP. But did he have any rights? Was his government considered as one of the sources that could be interviewed to have a clear picture of what really was going on? For a PE to be complete, the OTP has to concretely evaluate the seriousness of the information. And this should mean also gathering information from another party to the conflict. In the Gbagbo case, during the PE, the OTP never reached out to Laurent Gbagbo. But in what capacity should he have been approached? A witness? A person of interest? A suspect? An accused? One can consider that once a formal investigation is open, his legal status will become clearer, and so might be his rights. And how does the OTP have a clear picture of the situation at hand if they don't reach out to one of the main actors of the post-electoral crisis? We suggest that from the beginning of an examination, the OTP should have the duty to examine incriminating and exonerating circumstances equally. But if one of the targeted perpetrators of a PE is interviewed, this might constitute a risk for him in the future. For example, he or she might say things that could be used against him in the eventuality of opening a formal investigation, and that he or she becomes one of the main suspects. This is why the status and thus the rights of these targeted perpetrators, until now invisible, should be clarified. And that's what we evaluate in our chapter. What does it mean to be a potential suspect, a person of interest, or maybe the principle of témoin assisté, like it exists in the French procedure? In the Gbagbo case, it was clear that from the start, the targeted perpetrator could already be considered as accused. So why should he be deprived of his rights? Especially that in the Gbagbo case, until now, only one side has been officially prosecuted. In the Gabon situation, it is even clearer that the OTP will be confronted during the PE with information concerning crimes that might have been committed either by the state itself or by political opposition. But more interestingly for us, the OTP will be confronted with information that clearly identifies alleged perpetrators. The legal situation is the following. On the 21st of September 2016, the OTP received a referral regarding the situation in Gbagbo since May 2016 with no end date. The referral made by Gabon identifies as potential perpetrator Jean Ping. But this referral of the Gabon gave a legal framework for the members of civil society and the political opposition to also provide evidence to the OTP. So on the 15th of December, counsel mandated by Jean Ping, leader of the Gabonese Democratic Movement, and by Gabonese civil society officials and victims of repression led by the Gabonese authorities against the country's population, filed a communication with the OTP. So we have in Gabon a situation where there's a referral versus a communication. But more importantly, we have different persons of interest that we can already identify. The Gabon situation is a perfect opportunity to put in place during the PE the examination of incriminating and exonerating circumstances equally. In Gabon, even if there's a state referral, it might be not as clear whom the targeted perpetrators might be after an impartial examination. It is our opinion that from a policy perspective, the OTP could and should try to open lines of communication with possible perpetrators during a PE, and this is also explored further in our paper.
How does this work? Okay. So in the remaining 3-4 minutes I have, I just want to approach 2 or 3 more topics we look in our chapter, and you can read the chapter to have more detail of how the alleged perpetrator is taken into account in the PE. I mean, the first one is obviously admissibility, because, you know, as was discussed previously in Article 53, there is a reference to whether the case would be admissible or not. So what does this mean at the preliminary examination phase? Well, obviously there's no case, so you have this definition given by several chambers that you have to look at groups of persons involved that are likely to be the focus of an investigation, and crimes within the jurisdiction of the court allegedly committed during the incident that are likely to be the focus of an investigation. Now, this is requires some, you know, specificity. It's not just a vague looking at the crimes being committed. You have to identify both possible crimes and a group of perpetrators. Now, we developed this more in the paper, but I'm personally quite skeptical about having this whole admissibility stuff at the PE at all. Because, you know, ultimately, this group of person who might be the focus of an investigation, that's prosecutorial discretion. The prosecutor might tell us in policy papers that they're targeting the most responsible, but that's just a policy thing. You can't be held responsible for it or accountable for not following that in any case. So what are the judges going to check? You know, the prosecutor says, I want to focus on these people. So, and they're not being investigated, what can the judge say? And more generally, I think it's way too early in any kind of judicial process to look at admissibility at this stage. But this is just a teaser. You'll have to read the chapter. I basically say we should get rid of 53, but yeah, I'll let you read the chapter for that. The second point is the rights of the accused and the person under investigation under Article 55. Now, I don't have, again, enough time to go into detail. So, as if you don't know, Article 55 provides a certain number of protections for persons under investigation, including the fact that you're not arbitrarily detained, that you have a right to a lawyer, etc. And the question is, when does that start applying? The Gbagbo case is, again, a good example because, again, you might or might not know, but Gbagbo was arrested in April 2011 and detained in conditions which are akin to torture in the north of the country until he was sent to the court also in strange circumstances, in November 2011. And the defense filed a motion saying that, you know, this should lead to a stay of proceedings for violation of his rights. Can I take one more minute? And the answer of the court was to say that it didn't exclude the fact that it might apply during a PE, which is interesting. But it did say that you have to prove that the prosecutor either ordered, either himself tortured the person, or that the, you know, national authorities were acting on behalf of the prosecutor, which is a really high standard already to prove. We don't have access to the information. But also it's unrealistic because, I mean, obviously we might criticize the OTP, but they're never ordering torture to be committed. What we were asking in our motion was a minimum standard is ask. You're talking to the Ivorian authorities, ask them what's going on. Ask them if he's being treated correctly. You're investigating him. You have a minimum responsibility to ensure that his rights are respected. And the last point, which I won't develop, but when we discussed this with Morten initially, this paper, he asked me how I would include Regulation 55. And I'm the first one to want to criticize, discuss Regulation 55. So you'll have to read the paper to see what creative answers we've come up with to discuss Regulation 55, rights of the accused, during the preliminary examination. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.